Real life stories of real life men. These are the many voices of the Brothers in Blue Reentry Program. Real voices.
My as far as tragedies in my life, now there's a subject that if anything does define the type of person I am, it might be the fact that I'm living proof that a person can overcome just about anything. When I first found out who my real dad was, I was 13 years old. We'd gotten in trouble for stealing some stuff. And the cop asked who my dad was. And I was telling him on the paper, well, I don't know who my dad is. And my mom said, well, Von Morton is his dad. And when she said who my dad was, I was like, he's not my dad. She well, yeah, he is your dad. You know, I've never told you this, but it's time that you learn that this is who your real father is. Well, he was a major impact in my life. Well, 2 weeks after she told me that he was my dad, he was in a tragic wreck that he fell out of a van, and the van ran over him. He got asphyxiated. Well, we was two blocks away at a friend of mine's backyard. I had a go-kart, and we used to chase each other around in the go-kart. We seen the sirens, and so naturally as kids, we ran down there, and so we were like the first, you know, people actually on the scene besides the South Edge cop. And we started looking, and we seen the van. I'm like, wow, that's my dad's van, you know. I just had found out it was my dad. And I go over, and he was laying in a pool of blood, probably as big as this room. And they expected him not to live, you know. But he ended up, he did live. He was in a coma for the better part of a year.
Our inmate today has lived an intense life. As he said, he has become adept at overcoming adversity. Throughout his testimony today, you will see a boy, and then a man, struggling to find a place in this world where he feels accepted, and trying to realize his purpose. This journey and this quest have landed him in prison. But let's do what we do best and start from the beginning. Tell me about yourself a little bit. Just where'd you grow up? Maybe go into detail of your family structure a little bit.
Well, I grew up in Hutchinson, Kansas. I'm a middle child. I had an older sister and a younger brother. We all three have different dads. My mom was a barmaid, and she was married seven different times, so I had several different stepfathers plus numerous different boyfriends because my grandma had a restaurant that she did a work release program. And my mom kind of flirted around with a lot of guys that were coming on the work details and stuff. So needless to say, there was a lot of bad influences in my life growing up. She's the type of mother, she didn't want to tell us what to do or try to be an authority figure because she felt like that she'd already put us through enough. The small talks that I did have with her and stuff over the years, she let it be known that she wanted the best for us. And what she really felt was that if she was to intervene and to discipline us or anything like that, that we were going to lose her respect or her love. You know, she felt like in some way that she would be catering to it if she was to discipline us. So she kind of just let us do whatever we wanted to do. I mean, I could sneak out anytime I wanted to. I'd be gone for 2 or 3 days, and really my mom wouldn't even question where I was at as long as I'd call and just tell her, hey, you know, I'm not going to be home tonight. That was all good. It didn't matter where I was at or what I was doing. Yeah, she let me make decisions, and, you know, and when I made the wrong ones, she was the first one to be there to help me back up and tell me, you know, well, son, that's why you got to, you know, value life and your decisions that you make in it, because once you make them, that's what determines where you are and what you become. Who can really say what the right and wrong answers are or decisions that we make, you know, to teach our kids? We know that there are models that do work and stand out, and I believe that she probably didn't have a lot of that information because she, you know, came from a broken home too, as far as discipline and parenthood. So I mean, I just got to go with what happened and try to do something different for my kids. A lot of good things came from my childhood, even though, but they were like diamonds in the rough type of scenarios. She was married to a lead guitar player for a country and western band for a couple of years, and he did teach me how to play guitar, and one summer she let me go on the road with him. I would carry a little jug around, and I would make more money than what the band would, because they liked seeing a little kid up there so much that that became part of our routine while we were out on the road.
Okay, so his mom may have had her issues, but she did make him feel special on certain occasions. But who was there for the necessary advice? You know, the day-to-day operations of parenting.
Well, by my mom not being there, my sister did instill in me a lot of things. She was into old ancient Chinese literature and stuff, so she knew a lot about, like, the Art of War, books like that, you know, where she would always tell me all these little things about philosophy and stuff, you know, from the eyes of Egyptians and Chinese. So a lot of that sank in because, I mean, what my sister told me, I believed was golden. If your parents tell you to do something, you automatically just feel like that you shouldn't do it because they're telling you to do it. When my sister would do it, they were more like suggestions than some type of authority, you know, or dictatorship. The stepdad that had taught me how to play the guitar and stuff, Now he was in a major wreck too. Well, somebody had slipped some drugs into his drink at the club, and he crashed his car, and he started going crazy little by little. And so my mom, since she was the only one that worked, when she was gone, he would watch us, and we would tell her, you know, hey, he's being mean to us. He's doing crazy stuff. And he never physically molested us or anything, but he used to, like, take a belt and tie us up to the stove and put 22 shells on it and turn the electric burner on, and then he'd go in the other room, you know, so we'd be strapped to the stove, and they'd go off, of course, you know, they didn't hurt us, but they could have, and he'd take us out on dirt roads and drive us around and tell us we were running over dead bodies and that the world was coming to an end, that the axe murderers were chasing us, and he just started losing his mind little by little, and I don't know if he molested my sister, but I know that he slapped her around and beat her a lot, and at that time, I would have been like second or third grade. I ended up taking a bowling ball and smashing his car in and putting scratches to make it look like the neighbors did it because I was so mad at what he'd done to my sister. I started realizing it was having a major impact in my life. I didn't know it then, but later on I looked back on it and I was like, man, the decisions and stuff that I was making in my mind as a child was incredible. You know, I had to step up because I felt like I had to take care of my sister, and really that's why we were so close. You know, so when she died, you know, that was also another traumatic point in my life. It was like the only person that I could talk to about anything was my sister.
I feel like there's little need for me to analyze this inmate because he does it to himself. He said himself that those events had a big impact on him. So how exactly did this neglect and abuse translate into his behavior?
I was an out of control kid. I mean, really, you couldn't tell me to do anything I didn't want to do. And at school, I'd been kicked out of 3 different school districts for fighting. And I was just lashing out for attention more than anything. You know, I know that now looking back. But at the time, I attribute it to my mom not being there because I was always trying to do something more that went above and beyond what, you know, was required so that I could get that type of attention. By the time I was 16, I got a job at a car lot fixing up cars. When I found my niche in life, which was auto mechanics and playing guitar, I just went on my own. And at 16, I was living on my own and had 2 different apartments. Mm-hmm. But I also was involved in drugs. I was involved in full-scale distribution of marijuana and cocaine. Because of my age, there were several other drug smugglers that knew that there wasn't nothing that the law could really do to me if I was to get caught. So they would give me nice cars and great opportunities and pay my rent and set me up in houses and get me new furniture and stuff because I shine. I mean, if you give me something and you tell me this has got to work, I'm going to make it work because I'm going to apply myself to it, you know.
Our inmate got swept up into the type of lifestyle that preys on the broken and lonely. He needed money, he wanted comfort, and his survival instincts led him to a life of crime. But what about his family? Did he just turn a cold shoulder to them when he left, or what?
My sister always looked up to me. She never was into drugs or anything. But she loved the type of lifestyle that I was leading. And she would always come and hang out with me, and she would always bring her friends over. My sister had a massive stroke. She had three back-to-back strokes, and my mom found her dead on the kitchen floor. I knew when she had died, I was on the fishing bank, and I turned and looked at the girl that was with me, and I said, you know what? Something terrible happened to my sister. And she's like, she knew me well enough to know that she says, what do you think it is? I said, it's terrible. Something terrible has just happened to her. And knowing me as well as she did, she didn't even question it. She says, well, do you want to go? I said, there's nothing that we can do. And rather than think I was crazy, she just thought, well, maybe something is up. And then 2 days later, when my family had finally tracked down to where I was at, because I'm that type of person, you've got to really track me down. And they sent my uncle, who my sister hated, and he pulled into the driveway, and he says, hey, you know, something happened. I said, I already know.
So, tell me, what was it that brought you to prison the first time?
I got caught with 15 pounds of weed in the trunk of another guy's car. Long story short, I ended up with 3 to 10, and I got out on my first board hearing. It was scary because they put me at a facility that was all lifers that had worked their way down to medium custody. Those guys ended up being some of the best people to do time with because they realized that I was young and they helped me out. I got out, I did my whole 2 years on parole and moved to Illinois, Chicago, and lived with some friends of mine and got back into the same thing, got back into the drug trade. The only thing I took to Chicago with me was my drums and my clothes. I got a job at a service station that was ran by one of the most violent motorcycle gangs in the United States. And they kind of took me under their wing, the same as my other friends had done. They realized that I had potential and that anything that they gave me to take care of, they knew that it would get done. They never involved me into any of their violent activities, but I ended up meeting a girl that the vice president's son was dating, and she had 5 kids. The oldest at that time would have been 16, and the youngest was like 8 months old. Well, the guy was real mean to him. I mean, he'd trip him and slap him and everything else. And after seeing that a couple times, you know, I told him, I said, look, I can't stand to see kids abused because I'd seen my sister like that so many times and I wasn't going to tolerate it. And the first time he had told me to mind my business and I seen him trip one of the kids one day, so I went over there and I just tripped him and said, you know, how's that feel? You know, I mean, think about it. They're kids, they don't deserve it. And he told me, you know, warned me, you know, just watch what you do because stuff can happen up here. And, you know, me being like I am, you know, you can't really tell me anything. I believe if I'm on a quest now for something that's right and deserves to be heard or seen or spoken, then I'm going to do what's right. Mm-hmm. And that's what I ended up doing. I ended up putting an old Ford Econoline van together. And when he went to work one day, I told her, I said, here's the deal. If you want to get away from me, and we had spoke a little bit about it, I said, you put everything that you need in this big van. I'm going to back it up to the door. You put everything in it, put your kids in it, and I've already talked to my mom. She's in Kansas. I'm going to take you back there, and I guarantee she'll help you get on assistance or welfare or anything you need to do to get your kids in schools. Things did go good for them. All of them are doing good now. I adopted all 5 of them. They live in huts. They've all got good jobs and stuff. I got back involved with methamphetamines to try to make ends meet and spiraled down fast from there. I've got a checkered past with relationships, you know? And I'm sure that it ties somehow to my childhood. I mean, I've got five of my own kids from 5 different moms. I'll tell you, here's the thing. From that point, from my first PV until now, I've been in and out of prison so many times that I couldn't even tell you the dates or the lengths of stays, but I know that it's somewhere between 11 and 15 times that I've been to prison, even though I've only got 3 felonies. Mm-hmm. Because I was old law and I bounced in and out all the way up until I maxed that one, and then I caught another case. Every time I was released from prison, I got a new girlfriend, had another child, went back to prison.
Okay, kind of seems to me like his life has been this repetitive motion of him metaphorically banging his head against the wall, then questioning why he just did it, and then doing it all over again. So obviously he's in prison now. How'd he bang his head this time?
What charges are you in here on right now?
Manufacturing, possession of marijuana with intent to sell, possession of methamphetamine with intent to sell, possession of meth, possession of drug proceeds, possession of psilocybin, possession of pseudoephedrine, possession of lithium metal, possession of anhydrous ammonia.
And how much time did you get for all of that?
14 years. Well, ironic as it seems, the truth is, I pulled into the driveway of a house that was under surveillance. The cops waited till I went inside. They came in the house. They put me in handcuffs, and I didn't have no drugs on me. I didn't have no drugs in my vehicle. They went through the house. They found some drugs in the house, and they found a meth lab in a camper that belonged to somebody that was in jail at that time for manufacturing. They went to the landlord, who had a criminal history in manufacturing, asked him who the stuff belonged to, and of course he said it was mine, and they filed the charges on me. I'm the only person that they filed charges on, besides my cellie's wife. Here's the truth. I was guilty of everything that they charged me with, but not one thing that they charged me with.
Right.
Okay? I was doing every one of those things in my life.
Just not there.
But
where
not
they
there
go.
And not with those circumstances and not with those particular drugs.
Yeah.
Had they caught me at any other given day in my walk of life where I lived at, they could have gotten the same results.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make it right.
Yeah.
But it does make God an intervener. I was told I got corrections on the case, and I went to the corrections department and told them, look, I'm dirty. I need to reintegrate out of Reno County. I'll never make it. I want to do the right thing, so I'm not going to lie. I need to go to treatment, and I need to reintegrate. They had me get a SAC assessment. They said that was cool. They set it up. I had the bed to go to treatment. They put me in jail to wait for that date to come up. 3 days after I was in jail, the district attorney saw that I was in there and that I had admitted to methamphetamine usage. And rather than going to 28 days in treatment, I went back to court on the fifth day, and they gave me the 14 years.
So, back in prison again, he's joined Brothers in Blue Reentry. A rare opportunity to actually turn prison time into something productive. What was it that made him choose to humble himself and ask for this program's help?
What was it that made you decide to apply for this program once you came to prison for the umpteenth time?
I got down on my knees and I actually made an honest, you know, cry for repentance and redemption from the Lord, you know, and said, hey, you know, I've been trying to do it my own way, and I realize, you know, every time you've had me, you know, and you let me make my own mistakes, and then you pick me back up, but, you know, here I am, and I'm calling back out to you again. So what he did was, I was supposed to be going to another institution, and I had asked about IFI. That was my biggest concern was, you know, if I'm going to be down for 10 years with a good time, I want to go to IFI and just dedicate myself to the Lord. I said, I've been doing it my way. Now I believe it's time for me to start volunteering, step up, and try to do some stuff for some other people. The program has taught me a lot. I mean, it's been tough. I'm going to tell you, it's been an emotional roller coaster, because the more that I've gave, especially once I was baptized, it was like immediately I was hit with one thing after another. My mom's dying. She's got cancer. She's had 3 heart attacks. I mean, I could go on and on and on. I mean, things have gotten progressively worse.
Right.
But my attitude towards them has remained kind of neutral.
When the Spirit did come into my life, I started thinking I was losing my mind a little bit at first, because there were so many scenarios with funny coincidences and stuff that were happening that it was like, wow, are you sure? I mean, come on, this can't be real. And every book that I opened had a message to me. You know, and every Every sermon was like preached straight to me. Every phone call that I made to my people was in line with whatever the day's message was. You know, whatever the spiritual message was in my life that morning was the same that afternoon, and that thing, and it fit a main scheme that was for that week, and the theme of the month fell into alignment, and I started seeing that there was too many variables to be coincidental. It had to be the Spirit moving in my life. And with that type of reinforcement, I felt that I was being called to some type of God-sized vision that actually had a purpose. You know, whereas my life before was just like a senseless wandering, and I almost like to use the analogy of the 40 years in the desert, because it was at 40 years old that I realized I wanted to do something different. So I had like literally wandered in the desert for 40 years and come out of it with nothing. This program has gave me unlimited amount of time to apply myself just towards what my goal is. It's gave me a chance to just kind of sideline all those other issues that I have that I, you know, would be so wrapped up in on the streets that I wouldn't have time to really make an honest evaluation of where I'm at, where I'm going, or be able to try to discern spiritually what my intentions are in life, or what that God has in store for my life, you know, what my purpose is. So Brothers in Blue, it gave me a chance to just kind of seclude myself in this immersion of information and really look at it like, you know, a dry sponge in a wet room. And I can just soak up everything from all different angles and then kind of make a real life application of what I'm learning to try to bring my brothers up. I get prophetic visions and stuff all the time about what it is that the Spirit is pulling me towards. And although I can't comprehend what the plan is, I do know that there is one, and it has to do with audio engineering, and it has to do with fundraising and about spreading the gospel and message.
This inmate is a special breed. He knows he needs to change, and he understands the situation he put himself in. But at least he's willing to be that dry sponge in a wet room. But change in prison has to be sustained. This inmate seems to be self-aware, but if he gets too comfortable, it can be so easy to backslide. He's been through so much, as you heard, and he has so much left to experience. But it's up to him to choose the right path for himself and to open himself up to God's calling. He has humbled himself and admitted to needing God's help, which is commendable. But can he surrender every day? Only time will truly tell. Thank you for joining us on Real Voices. Tune in next week for our next installment.